State lawmakers added a dime per gallon to Iowa's gas tax during the 2015 legislative session, but what else did they accomplish? I'm Dean Borg, in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day on River to River. We're discussing the just-adjourned Iowa legislative session. State House correspondents Joyce Russell of Iowa Public Radio, Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, James Lynch, who writes for the Gazette published in Cedar Rapids, and Aaron Murphy of Lee Enterprises will be joining me. That's coming up next on River to River, after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. Dean Borg continuing River to River from Iowa Public Radio's Des Moines studio. And with me are State House reporters who spend every day at the session is in session and up at the State House. And so we're going to pick their brains, if you will. And we want you to weigh in, too. And might as well just tell you right now that the number to call is 866-780-9100 or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So the number is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org on the email. And good afternoon, Kay Henderson.
Hello.
Kay is with Radio Iowa, spends every day up at the session. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio, State House correspondent. Joyce, good afternoon.
Hello, Dean.
And Aaron Murphy is with Lee Enterprises. He is their Capital Bureau Chief. Nice to have you here, Aaron.
Good to be here, Dean. Thanks.
And James Lynch writes for the Gazette, published in Cedar Rapids. Nice to work with you again, Jim.
Thanks, Dean.
Jim, I'm going to ask you, first of all, you know, I don't know whether or not you can remember the old song, and I'm not going to sing it for you.
But
there's a song that goes, high hopes, high hopes, high apple pie in the sky hopes. You remember that old song?
I think I've heard it before, yeah.
Well, maybe I have you sing it. But the lyrics are, don't be intimidated by tough tasks, overwhelming odds. Well, that leads up to the question, Jim. Did the 2015 Iowa General Assembly overcome the odds against significant achievement in an environment of shared power, Republicans controlling the House, Democrats the Senate?
Well, I think we started out with high hopes and maybe apple pie high hopes. But I would have to say no. I don't think they overcame those odds. They did achieve some significant legislation. But I think when you look at the session in totality, I think Democrats probably are discouraged that they weren't able to do more. Many Republicans are probably discouraged that they did too much.
And Aaron Murphy, what do you say on that?
Yeah, I agree. It was, and my take is, I have a feeling is going to step a little bit on the toes of what we'll get a little bit deeper into here eventually. But the one of the major pieces of legislation James was talking about was the gas tax, and my take was that once that was passed, that there was so much effort and political capital put into that that I don't know that there was a lot of stomach for doing much more after that.
We will talk about that gas tax a little bit more, Aaron. I want to hear what Joyce Russell thinks about the overall achievement of the Iowa legislature.
Well, just numerically, there were fewer bills passed than in some sessions. That's not necessarily a measure mm-hmm. of quality, mm-hmm. and some people would say that's just fine if you're passing fewer pieces of legislation. I don't think there's any doubt that the divided legislature caused the delay in the end.
And Kay Henderson.
Well, I think in 10 years, we'll look back on this session and say that the gas tax was a major achievement.
When we're all driving on pothole-free roads.
And then secondarily, there are going to be perhaps more cell phone towers placed around the state and perhaps more broadband expanded, although I'm not quite sure people will understand that. But at least they laid a groundwork for maybe expanding the network to underserved and unserved areas of the state.
Kay, I predict that in 10 years they'll be debating another gas tax increase,
right,
saying that it's long overdue.
That's Jim, and expand on that.
Well, the 10 cent a gallon increase this year was sort of to cover a shortfall, what the DOT calls critical needs, of about $200 million a year. And I think the people who were pushing for an increase this year understand that that just sort of catches them up. It doesn't get them ahead of the game at all. And it won't be long before we'll need more revenue to address transportation.
Joyce, Russell?
And in fact, after the gas tax passed and was actually signed into law, a longtime transportation expert in the House, Dennis Cahoon, a Democrat from Burlington, they're debating the transportation bill, and he said flat out, look for another gas tax. This is not, this is great that we did this, but it's not going to cover the need.
Is that realistic, Kay?
It is realistic, and I think this debate was interesting in that at one point over the past 2 years, the key individuals involved in it started talking about alternatives to a per-gallon tax. You have the state of Oregon that's experimenting with the idea of charging people a per-mile tax. I can't even imagine the technology that might be required for that. But if legislators are considering this 10 years from now, I would think that they're not talking about a per-gallon tax, but some other way to collect revenue from the people who use the roads.
Joyce?
And I will say that this is some of the bitterest infighting that I think I've seen, or at least for a long time, with Republicans, especially Republicans in the House. There was such strong feeling against the gas tax. And Speaker Paulson did some, if not unprecedented, it's certainly unusual steps to make sure he appointed himself to the Ways and Means Committee. And then many, or at least some Republicans in the end felt like they'd been squelched and hadn't been able to stand up and vent.
It was as bitter as I've seen since they had some gambling debates in the legislature. That really split Republicans down the middle when they passed riverboat gambling and gambling expansion.
But Aaron, was it a party split? It was bipartisan. You couldn't really tell which side either were on. Was it an urban-rural split or what?
Yeah, it was. You're absolutely right. It was not bipartisan. Both caucuses, all four caucuses, and both parties were split. And I don't think it was necessarily rural or urban either. I think it came down to literally individual districts and legislators hearing what they heard from their constituents.
But, Jim, how did that then poison the rest of it? Are people bitter about being pushed into one side or the other?
I think some people, for many Republicans, they don't want to vote for any tax increase. And this is not an election year, so there's less danger, I suppose. But even for many Democrats, they don't want to vote for any sort of a tax increase that's going to be hung around their neck come election time. But it pushed people into tough situations. There were people who knew they were taking a political chance by voting for this, but understood the need. You know, it's interesting. There were some of the early leaders on this issue were from rural Iowa, people who saw rural bridges and some rural roads in real poor condition. And
legislator from Northwood led the fight on that, didn't he?
Or Osage. Josh Burns. Tim Capuchian from Benton County was another one.
Brian Moore from Jackson County.
Yeah, Brian Moore from Jackson County. So, I mean, there were a lot of rural legislators who were willing to go ahead and push for this.
Are they going to pay a price then, Kay?
Well, if history is any guide, Democrats certainly paid a price after they raised the licensing fee for minivans several years ago. They lost control of the Iowa House because of it, because Republicans made a huge issue of it in key races with key legislators. So this is going to come up in 2016 in individual races. I wouldn't, be surprised to see some of the Republicans who voted for it get a primary challenger out of this as well.
The Iowa Taxpayers Association was against it. David Stanley, I remember.
Iowans for Tax Relief.
Iowans for Tax Relief. That's right. Iowans for Tax Relief. But are they?
They're not as big a player.
That's right. They're not strong enough to really
in politics. Americans for Prosperity was a player in this to a greater extent this time around.
But Kay and Jim, you and I have just come from a session in a conversation with Craig Paulson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and Mike Gronstall, who leads the Democrats in the Senate, we asked them that question about, will there be a follow-on tax for this because this only is catch-up and doesn't have enough for the future? And both of them were pretty emphatic on, you won't see this again soon.
That's what they have to say in this political environment. It would be just something they couldn't do, is to say, okay, we raised the tax this year, we're going to come back next year and do it again.
Dean, this is James Lynch. What I found most interesting about that conversation when we were asking them about the gas tax is Craig Paulson's comment that, oh, you know, after the vote, within a week, we were just sort of back to normal. Everything was back to normal. And it was like, I didn't see that. And it, when what I was hearing from members of the House, especially where I spend most of my time, I would say it didn't get back to normal after 145 days.
Yeah. Well, Joyce, did that then have a role in the quandary about school funding? That is, was that one of the pieces of legislation then that the choosing upsides on the gas tax and the price to pay there politically, did that have any, what legislation did it affect, and was school funding one of them?
Well, it may have just created a more divided atmosphere in the caucus, which may have contributed to the struggle to get school funding and the entire budget passed.
Jim? Yeah, I would say I think that's a good point. We often talk about tension between Republicans and Democrats and tensions between the Senate and the House, but quite often it's the tension within any one of those caucuses that can impede progress. And I think especially in the House Republican caucus, it made it harder to reach consensus on any number of issues after the gas tax was approved.
I'm going to go to another subject because we have a caller who wants to know about gun legislation, and it's Kathy from Des Moines. Kathy on the line?
Afternoon.
Yes. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yes, I was wondering why the Republicans are so obsessed with rolling back gun laws, fireworks, and things like that when they should be talking about education and much more important things like that, even the bullying bill that their own governor wanted as a priority passed. I really, really shook my head a lot this year.
And you're citing the Republicans for what you say is shortfall there. Is that right, Kathy?
That's it, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy, for that call. I'm going to ask Jim Lynch to weigh in on that, maybe followed by Joyce Russell. Jim?
Well, I think it's, I mean, gun rights is an integral part of the Republican Party mindset at this time. And some of the things they proposed this year are common in other states, the noise suppressors for guns, for example, which they tried to argue was a health issue to preserve people's hearing. Some of the other issues probably weren't safety issues. And I'd also point out that, you know, in the House, it was the vote was, I think, 74 to 25. There was a lot of bipartisan support for those measures. And over in the Senate, the floor manager of that bill told me there were enough votes to pass it. There just weren't enough Democratic votes to pass it.
Joyce?
And I would add that the way they put the bill together, it was a product of talks with the law enforcement community. And there were things in that bill that the county sheriffs really wanted that had to do with gun permitting. And so they you know, very, very skillfully put a coalition together, and that got it going further than it otherwise would have, I believe.
Aaron Murphy?
And to add on what James was saying about the fireworks goes sort of in that similar vein with the Republicans who supported that, as they see it as an individual liberty thing, that Iowans should be able to display certain types of home fireworks if they'd like, and to that end, also 40 other states have laws that are more loose than Iowa's fireworks restrictions.
The number that kept getting tossed around was a $35 million economic impact for Iowa if fireworks were legalized. So that made it attractive to some people. And it's also one of those things, as Aaron was saying, 40 states legalized fireworks. It's fun. It's American, I guess. You know, to a lot of people, that's the way they look at it.
Kay Henderson?
And fireworks is another one of the issues that legislators sort of dove into that had bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. It was like medical marijuana. They had people who were Republicans and Democrats who desperately wanted that legislation, and there were Republicans and Democrats, you know, adamantly opposed to it as well.
Joyce?
And I would add about the fireworks, you know, there was a definite lull and just almost a dead stop while the leaders were negotiating on the budget. There was many times the legislators weren't even called back. So there was kind of some time for mischief to focus on that fireworks bill. And I think during the regular session, it didn't make it through. And I think if they hadn't been so much delay on the budget, I don't think it would have gotten that attention in the end.
When the cat's away, the mice will play. Is that it? Aaron Murphy?
And I was going to add, the caller asked about the anti-bullying legislation. That one was very interesting to me as well, and I followed that closely throughout the session. As she mentioned, it's a priority of the governor, but he couldn't get his own party members, the House Republicans, to support that. They had concerns
Let me just interrupt you, just to underscore what you've just said. 2 years ago, if not more, Kay, 3 years ago, you're holding up three fingers. 3 years ago, the governor trotted out this anti-bullying legislation. Naive me thought, oh, this is a slam dunk. That is, that will go through, just sail right on through. Why doesn't he really get serious about something tough? Wow, was I wrong, Aaron? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And last year, both parties, both chambers passed a bill, but they had differences, and they couldn't iron out those differences in the conference committee.
But what are the differences, Joyce? I mean, who's against bullying children?
Well, last year, the differences were over the role that parents should play and the degree to which parents should be notified if there is trouble in the schools. That was the whole sticking point last year. But it's very interesting that this year it passed the Senate, and then it couldn't even get past the House, even though it was roughly the same thing as was before them the year before. And this is purely speculative, but I think that there were conservatives in the Republican caucus that were throwing their weight more this year, and I would even go out on a limb and tie that back to the gas tax, that they got thwarted, and so then when it was time to do the bullying bill, they said, no, we're not going to do that.
And the parental notification, that's an interesting thing. As you mentioned, that was the hang-up last year, so they made it what Democrats were concerned was with automatic notification and the potential that the victim could be further harmed mentally by notifying some parents. So they added a provision with an exception, and that created opponents on the flip side of that this year. So the parental notification was, again, a stumbling block for a different reason.
So, Kay, is this an individual family rights type argument?
That as well. And this is one of the fascinating issues that you encounter up at the legislative session, where when you go to the extremes, you have the family leader on one hand adamantly opposed to the bill, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa also lobbying against the mm-hmm. bill for different reasons. So it failed because of the fact that the governor hasn't been able to convince his own fellow Republicans to embrace it.
I'm glad you brought up the subject. That was my next question. Does that show an ineffectiveness in the power of the governor? I'm asking you, Joyce Russell, first of all, to weigh in on this. Is the governor not providing sufficient leadership in the legislature, or is it impossible for the governor? Is that too much to ask?
I just think we can say that the House Republicans are not going to walk in lockstep with the governor, and they were able to influence a lot of what happened this year as a result.
Jim Lynch?
One thing I would say, and this is really speculative, is that the governor proposed a very timid, limited agenda this year. And bullying maybe was kind of the big piece of his agenda. But sometimes you have to put a little sugar in the recipe to get people to accept the acid or the, you know, the acidic taste, whatever. And I don't think there was any sugar in there for Republicans. And they just saw, you know, they didn't like broadband last year. They finally came around this year to kind of a modified broadband proposal. But the governor didn't give them anything to offset the big, you know, bite he was asking them to take on bullying.
Aaron Murphy?
Yeah, that's a good point. And by extension of that, the gas tax as well.
And I would add, I think sort of the unspoken thing in this debate is there's social conservatives in the House. You know, one of the focuses of the bullying bill is protection for gay and lesbian students. And there are social conservatives in the House who really object to the governor's emphasis on that and even called obscene some of the things that were said in the governor's summit meeting on gay and lesbian protection. So if I'd been sitting in that conference, I mean, in that caucus, I'm sure that that's what was one of the things that was being said.
You know, going back to what I said earlier and my question to you, Jim, and that was the song High Hopes, High Hopes. We had such high hopes going into this session. One of the reasons for High Hopes, Kay, was that it's a non-election year. Mm-hmm. And we thought that that would enable some maybe controversial partisan things to maybe not be as partisan. Was that the case?
No. I think that these folks have engaged in campaigns that are escalating in cost and escalating in intensity in terms of the rhetoric that's used at the legislative level. Mm-hmm. And they come to Des Moines, to the State House, having been elected in that environment, and they have a chip on their shoulder.
Are we seeing, Aaron, they've always prided themselves that we're not like Washington, but are we seeing just a replica of Washington gridlock?
I wouldn't call it a carbon copy yet, but we see signs. You know, in this year's budget negotiations are certainly an indication of that.
Jim Lynch?
I would say that it's gotten more difficult for them to reach meaningful compromises, and I think there are a variety of reasons. One of them is that there is a constant campaign in Iowa. The campaigning never stops. It might not be a legislative election year, but there are campaigns going on here, and so those issues are always churning. People are paying attention to those issues, whether they're a state-level issue or a federal-level issue, and I think it just makes it harder for the parties to find that common ground.
One thing, Kay, that we haven't talked about here before we take our news break in a couple of minutes is medical marijuana. We thought that had been enabled a session ago, but apparently the families are unable to obtain it under the current legal system for transporting marijuana or in Iowa. Is that the problem? And that wasn't at all mitigated during this session, was it?
It was not addressed, and I think the advocates of this miscalculated the extent to which the leaders in the House, Republicans Craig Paulson and Linda Upmeyer, resented greatly the way in which it was passed last year. They were essentially rolled by their own people to bring that bill up. They did not have it on their agenda. They didn't want it to pass. And they were adamantly opposed to bringing it up this year. And the bill that cleared the Senate would have greatly expanded it as a treatment for a wide variety of maladies, not just intractable epilepsy for children.
So what we have right now is an enabling. It can be used.
You can possess it. You can possess cannabis oil. You just can't buy it in Iowa. You have to go out of state and risk prosecution by bringing it through Nebraska if you go to Colorado, et cetera.
Quickly, Aaron.
And the other problem with that is most states that have the programs only produce it and sell it for their residents. So on top of being able to not transport across lines, you can't even get it there.
Well, and one idea that was out there that didn't really get any traction at all was to legalize the production and marketing of the product here. Grow it like another plant.
Well, we'll suspend our conversation here, and we'll be back right after Dennis Reese has the news. This is Iowa Public Radio and River to River.
Support comes from Rob Weingeist.
Continuing River to River, and I'm Dean Borg in Iowa Public Radio's Des Moines studio with Radio Iowa News Director Kay Henderson, Aaron Murphy, who writes for Lee Enterprises, the newspapers, and also what else?
Davenport, Waterloo, Sioux City, Mason City, Muscatine newspapers.
Right. Aaron Murphy is our Capital Bureau Chief for that enterprise. Joyce Russell is our Iowa Public Radio Capital Correspondent. And James Lynch writes for the Gazette, published in Cedar Rapids. And Kay, just before we had Dennis Reese with the news, we were talking about medical marijuana. And do you think that is a dead subject now? Is there an impasse and all that's going to be done has been done, or what?
Well, you have surrounding states of Minnesota and Illinois with programs which are proffering medical marijuana to qualified residents under those states' programs. And then we have what's happening at the federal level in terms of the trickle down from gridlock and, you know, partisan battles. This is going to trickle down to Iowa legislators and Iowa legislative races, because there's going to be a debate at the presidential campaign level about legalizing medical marijuana, because you have so many states that have taken steps. You have people like Rand Paul and Chris Christie on completely different pages on this debate, and it's going to be discussed during a presidential candidate debate, and Iowa legislators are going to be impacted on that. It's going to percolate through the body politic.
George Russell?
Would say, I mean, I'll go out on a limb and say, as long as we have a divided legislature, we're not going to see medical marijuana approved by a Republican chamber.
Not incrementally at all.
Boy, they, like Kay was saying, they sort of, the leadership sort of were rolled into passing that very, very limited, it turns out ineffective, medical marijuana cannabis oil last year.
And it would seem to me that the families who lobbied so passionately for that, Jim Lynch, might feel betrayed.
I don't know about betrayed. I think they feel like they've put their heart and soul into it and they aren't getting anywhere. I don't look for them to give up. I think this is, divided legislature or not, it's going to be hard to avoid addressing, because as Kay mentioned, other states are addressing it. It's going to be part of the presidential campaign discussion. And I mean, it's like a lot of issues where, you know, legislators have to take their time and find a way to support it. If you're a law and order Republican and you've fought against, you know, any legalization of drugs for decades, you know, you don't get over that overnight. But when you see people, for example, Representative Clell Baudler, former state trooper, who came around last year on the very limited medical marijuana proposal, people like that, people can change their spots.
Aaron Murphy, where do you think the governor stands on that? I've heard him use the phrase many times, we don't want any unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm. And I would, that leads me perfectly into what I was going to say is that there are other states that are doing this, and I think that's going to be a big part of what happens in Iowa. So Iowa will be able to look at these other states and see if any of those unintended consequences are happening, if teen marijuana use rises or something along those lines. Then that makes it a harder sell for those who oppose it right
Joyce?
Now.
And those families who lobbied so effectively for this in the 2014 session, they changed hearts and minds. I don't think there's any mm-hmm. doubt about that. And I kind of felt this year when they were back up there, I was kind of sorry to see this going in the direction of more full-fledged medical marijuana instead of tinkering with what they got last year and make it work for them better. To me, there was no chance that they were going to pass medical marijuana this year. And as a result, those families got nothing.
Jim Lynch?
Well, and the other thing we hear Governor Branstad say is we don't want to become Colorado. Well, that hasn't been the proposal at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, the proposals here have been for pretty much for medical marijuana. What muddied the waters this year is there were proposals to sort of decriminalize or decrease the penalties for possession of small amounts of marijuana. And I think that sort of gave opponents cover of where they could say, oh, no, we're not going to do that, so we're not even going to look at medical marijuana.
An invitation here to those of you who are listening to this discussion around the Iowa Public Radio table here in Des Moines. It's really kind of a kitchen table discussion, if you will. But you can join us. You don't have to pull up a chair here, but you can join us on the telephone. And the number is 866-780-9100 if you'd like to weigh in. Or you can email a question to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, you heard Dennis Reese also on the newscast just a couple of minutes ago talking about comments that Craig Paulson and Mike Gronstall had made during taping of Iowa Press this morning regarding the traffic cameras that are so controversial in Iowa. Now, Cedar Rapids, just yesterday, the city council decided that they are going to sue the Iowa Department of Transportation in order to keep a couple of traffic cameras that we have been ordered to be taken down and not to move to others. And Des Moines is pondering whether or not they'll sue. Sioux City has already said, we are taking the DOT to court. Council Bluffs has red light cameras, and Mike Gronstall said we're not involved in the speeding. It's the red light cameras in Council Bluffs, and we like them. Davenport has decided not to sue. Muscatine is still pondering. So, Kay, you heard the response this morning, and when you were at, and well, go ahead and recount that conversation.
Craig Paulson, the Speaker of the House, said the legislature should weigh in on this. The legislature establishes the speed limit on interstate highways. The legislature should establish the principles for where traffic enforcement cameras may be placed around the state.
That is not going to go over well. I interrupted you, and you can continue on, but that's not going to go over well with Ron Corbett, the mayor of Cedar Rapids, who has consistently said, this is a local control issue. Don't tell us what to do, Iowa DOT. Now he might have the legislature weighing in.
He might. He also may take that message to the campaign trail. He may be a candidate for governor himself. Senator Gronstall articulated the reason why legislators haven't done anything on this issue. Every time it comes up, there are people who want to limit the amount that the ticket can be issued for. They want to restrict how much money the vendors that provide the cameras may receive and the cities receive. And then there are a group of legislators who want to ban the things altogether. And so you cannot get a consensus because you have so many people with so many different views on what these cameras should be used for and how they should function.
Well, James Lynch, you drive down I-380 through the middle of Cedar Rapids and you deal with the traffic cameras there. You know how contentious that is
in
Cedar, in Cedar Rapids. Were you surprised this morning by what Craig Paulson said, being right from that area?
I was somewhat surprised. And as you said, I do drive Interstate 380, and when they put those cameras in, we saw a very quick adaptation by motorists who quite often I was driving 70, 75 in that stretch of road where the speed limit goes from 60 to 55, and traffic really slowed down, and we saw a dramatic difference. The police chief has all sorts of safety statistics. There have been no fatal crashes in the S-curve there in Cedar Rapids. But the point I was going to make is this is another case of why it's so hard to make legislation. I mean, I think people could agree that it makes sense to have a uniform policy so when I go from Cedar Rapids to Sioux City to Davenport to Des Moines, I know what the rules are. But then cities say, wait a minute, what happened to home rule? You're trying to preempt us. So there are a lot of different oxes getting gored in any debate like this, and it makes it hard to come to what most people would see as sort of a common sense solution.
I want to also play a piece of tape from the Iowa Press interview this morning, or just a little over an hour ago it was concluded, in which we asked Speaker Mike Gronstall and Speaker Paulson were the guests on the program, and Speaker Paulson was asked whether this session demonstrates that a divided legislature means getting nothing accomplished.
Iowans get to pick the makeup of the General Assembly, and this is what they chose. As the senator said, we didn't pick each other. Iowans did, and they expect us to go to work. But the makeup that Iowans picked is not a system that is designed for great speed and you know, just churning out bills. That's not what they chose. I think I will tell you, the two of us, I believe, are very committed to making sure we move the state forward and work through and find those opportunities.
Let's include another person in this, Governor Branstad as well. Mr. Gronstall, could the governor, in his actions now in the next few weeks, affect, poison the well, if you will, for the next session in what he chooses to veto and line item veto?
He could do things that would make it more difficult next year. Yes, he could. He did things last year that made it more difficult for this year. In spite of that, we worked with the governor on things like anti-bullying legislation, on things like broadband. We helped him accomplish his goals. We tried to work with him on the mental health institutes and the whole mental health delivery system in the state. We will continue. My rule since I became the Democratic leader was, my staff asked, what do you want to do? I said, when we can achieve good public policy, do it. When we can't, commit smart politics. That's been my motto, and that'll be my motto next year, regardless of what he does this year. If I can pursue good public policy with him, I will do it. If I can pursue it with Mr. Speaker, I'll do it. That's my life.
Okay, that's Senator Gronstall saying, that's my life. He says, I am a nice guy to work with, and I'm easy to work with. That's not the exact words, but you heard what he was saying there. But he was also, I thought, sending a message to Governor Branstad.
Of course. And there's always tension between the executive and legislative branches. You know, the old joke is, what do United States senators do? They sit around and dream about being president. There's a share of members of the Iowa House and Senate who sit around and think, you know, if I were governor, I'd be doing a much better job than this guy who's been doing it for a million years. So in addition to the tension that there is there, there's also the fact that House Republicans as a group are more conservative than Terry Branstad is. And there were a number of issues that were an issue of, you know, divided government, and you had Terry Branstad and Senate Democrats on one side, and you had House Republicans on the other, for instance, for decisions about many spending issues. You had Senate Democrats and the governor on one side and House Republicans on the other.
Jim Lynch, I'm asking you, and you can comment on what Kay, but specifically to you, where might Governor Branstad, where are Democrats especially watching to see if the well might be poisoned for next year's cooperative session?
Well, I think the first target probably is that one-time spending bill, about $135 million. That includes money, $55.7 million for K-12 schools. It has money in there for Regents institutions and a variety of other things. And in the past, Governor Branstad has indicated he doesn't like that approach to funding state government.
Appropriating one-time money.
Right. And so I think it looks like there's $135 million in veto bait sitting right there in front of him. I think they'll look and see what he does with the funding they put in for mental health institutes. And in that one-time money is money for the Regents institutions, which is essential to guaranteeing a third year of a tuition freeze at the universities.
Joyce Russell?
And that's really, I think that's really why the Democrats fought as long as they did to get the appropriations in the regular general fund appropriation, because as Jim is saying, this way it's just hanging out there on a limb, very easy to strike it out. Whereas if they had won in the general appropriation, won the percentage increase that they wanted, then the governor would have had to veto the whole thing, which is a lot harder to do.
Mm-hmm. Erin Murphy?
Yeah, Democrats don't feel great about the deal they got this year. With a few swipes of the governor's pen, they could get really sick about this session. And I think the big ones, Jim listed them off there, I think they would be disappointed, but they'd live with if the MHI language got struck.
That's
I think
mental
they see
health
some
institute.
Mental health institute language. I think they see an inevitability there. Those two school funding pieces for K-12 and higher education, if either of those get struck down by the governor, the Democrats are going to throw a fit.
I was talking to a senator just last night who speculated that if the governor would veto either one of those, legislators might call themselves back to override it. And he said Democrats would definitely, you know, be in support of overriding the governor's veto. And he thought there might be support from Republicans who, you know, maybe in their heart of hearts would agree with the veto, but not, and, you know, they worked long and hard to get to this point, and then to have the governor veto it, they might just say, oh, no, not this time.
Well, Kate, you know, help us understand this. He can't veto the entire, could veto the entire appropriation. He won't do that, doesn't leave any money. So what are we talking about here in vetoing?
Iowa's governor, unlike president, has item veto authority. So any spending bill, the governor has the ability to, you know, just take his pen and X out
line
lines
item.
Of them, which mm-hmm. is why it's called a line item veto. I do think it will be, I think the well indeed will be poisoned for next year if he does take the step of erasing the $55.7 million.
But that goes back to my question, Joyce. Doesn't that just take and erase that money? I mean, then the funding that was intended for whatever agency we're talking about here, and it is higher education in this case, that money's gone.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Money for K-12 schools, money for, I think there's community college money mm-hmm. in there, money for the regents that was intended to make possible the tuition freeze, yes.
And the irony here is he accepted this sort of finance mechanism in 2013, whereby legislators approved a standard increase in the state's support of K-12 public schools, and then they had this one-time money, and the governor said it was okay in 2013. So he's going to have some explaining to do if he decides now it's not okay.
Well, Kay, Aaron Murphy, has given us kind of a crystal ball look. He's going to have some explaining to do if he does X, Y, Z. Is that the way that you see it? I don't want you I don't think your crystal ball is that clear, but do you anticipate that that is a real possibility?
That he will strike some of these big things down? Yeah, it is. I mean, he's.
But politically, can that.
Well, he doesn't have another election to run, more than likely. I guess he would have to think about
the outcry already from K-12 schools.
Yes.
And they're not satisfied with what they're getting now. And what, if I understand Kay correctly, they could be getting even less.
Even less. I think it's fair to question whether K-12 funding is a motivating factor at the polls. And maybe that's because of that, it's a calculation and a risk the governor is willing to take.
You're shaking your head yes, Kay.
Absolutely. How many Iowans have a child of school age? Mm-hmm. Those are the people most invested in it. And people who don't send their children to a public school, mm-hmm. they send their school to a parochial school or they homeschool their children, they have even less interest in the state increasing general support for mm-hmm. public schools.
Another question I asked in this interview that concluded about an hour ago or so was, I asked Craig Paulson, we often hear Iowa doesn't have a spending problem, we have a revenue problem. And I asked Craig, in light of a decreasing farm economy, bird flu, and things like that, that I asked Craig Paulson, does Iowa have a revenue problem? Might we see and need an increase in taxes? And he emphatically said he rejected that.
Well, that's because Republicans are out there saying we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. Republicans went into this session with the idea that they wanted to pare back, contract the size of the state government. And in fact, next year, their high hope is to go in there and cut taxes significantly, income taxes significantly.
And but certainly Governor Branstad, in all of his comments about the likelihood of signing all of this budget, he cites a revenue problem, and he's concerned about the decline of farm income.
Yes.
He mentions the bird flu as sort of dark flags on the future.
Yes, Jim Lynch?
Well, and the revenue problem is something of their own making, with passing the commercial property tax revenue break a couple years ago, with the teacher leadership education reform package, and making commitments out into the future on these. They've sort of set up a revenue problem, and they've locked up a lot of money if they're going to honor those commitments. And that was a problem this year. There's new revenue, but they've already spent most of it.
Joyce, I'm going to ask you about the relative weight of the effective leadership in the Iowa legislature and the executive branch. That is, here we have the House controlled by Republicans. Craig Paulson is the speaker there. Governor Branstad in the executive branch. And we have the Senate with a slim Democratic majority. It seems, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll ask all of you, but Joyce first, it seems, though, that Democratic slim majority in the Senate dictates a lot of what gets done in the Iowa legislature.
Well, they didn't dictate what got done on the school start date, for example. I mean, the governor and the Republican House were lockstep on that, and they got their way. However, in other instances, the Republicans in the House got their way flat out, especially on the level of spending. The Democrats and the governor were in lockstep on how much general fund spending they wanted, and the House Republicans won that one. So it can kind of go either way.
Jim Lynch?
On some of the social issues, that it's true that the Senate Democrats probably control the agenda more than the House Republicans or the governor. And we saw it, for example, on the gun rights legislation where because there wasn't a majority in the Democratic caucus in the Senate who wanted to support that bill. I think it was the same with fireworks, again, where there wasn't a majority in the Senate Democratic caucus who wanted to support it, so they didn't even bring it to the floor, though there was bipartisan support in the House.
And that's just it. Some things don't even get brought up because they are going nowhere.
That's right.
That's what I was going to say. It's maybe more accurate to say the Senate Democrats control what doesn't pass in the Iowa legislature than what does.
Well, thank you, all of you. We've been talking with Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell, Aaron Murphy of Lee Enterprises, Kay Henderson, Radio Iowa, and James Lynch of the Gazette published in Cedar Rapids. Lindsay Moon did a lot in producing this program, and she has help from Emily Woodbury and Claire Roth in producing River to River. Executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Dennis Reese assisting us today in production, John Pemble in Des Moines, and Tony Daner also. I'm Dean Borg, and River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.